Welcome to The Upper Hand, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all aspects of hand surgery, from technical to personal.
Thank you for subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
I am great. This is an impromptu session.
I know. I'm excited. Well, you know, I had the whole day blocked off for the research management committee meeting for the Hand Society, in which we review all of the basic science and clinical grants. So usually I'm told it's an in-person meeting with a fun series of events planned around it. But the only ones that I've gone to have been Zoom all day.
You know, I've had a few of those all-day Zoom meetings replacing a fly-in, fly-out. And there are advantages because there's no fly-in, fly-out, but it is tough, I think, to sit and converse, especially on something like grants.
This is a committee where I think this would have been much better in person, but, you know, we're still in trying to figure out who can travel and when people are comfortable traveling. So hopefully the next meeting is back in person.
How big a group?
Looks like it was about 20 to 25 of us.
Oh, wow.
Maybe it felt like that. It's a pretty big committee.
Well, I'm sure everyone associates grant writing with fun people. So of course it is.
I guess it takes one to know one. any, what have you been up to?
Nothing. It's, you know, summer's here. It's getting busier as far as my peds world practice is getting busier. The hand world practice is pretty busy. And, administrative life has got me down a little bit. It's just a lot of, it never stops. There's always a challenge, which is both good and sometimes frustrating. But my to-do list never ends. But I think I speak to everyone in our audience when I say, does anyone's to-do list ever end?
Well, we all talk about getting to that inbox zero and the one, when was that? We had that episode about the one thing, right? So maybe you'll get there one day, Chuck.
I am going to keep trying. That's all we can do. Any good reviews out there?
Yes, we had a great review and it actually has a question for Chuck. So this is from username mchecker1 and thank you for the 5-star review on Apple iTunes. Says, hi guys, I'm an occupational therapist, CHT in Green Bay, Wisconsin. I took a new position 6 months ago with a longer commute 3 days a week, and your podcasts have made it so much more worthwhile. I truly enjoy the variety of topics, good humor, and up-to-date research in our world of hand surgery and therapy. Keep up the good work. Question for Chuck. Feel free to answer too, Chris. What is the most important thing about hand therapists need to know when working with hand surgeons? Thanks again. And this is from Megan. Thanks, Megan.
Yeah, totally. Thank you, Megan. And I don't know if Megan or other hand therapists are coming to St. Louis in October for the ASHT meeting, which I was super excited to be a part of. And my middle child is heading off to college in his parents' weekend. And I don't always show for all the things that I should show for. So I'm going to be at that parents' weekend. So Chris and I are going to try to do something creative around the Upper Hand podcast. And I think that's going to be my only contribution, but that meeting will be great. And Megan, if you're coming into town, look up Chris for sure. He'll be there. And thank you again for the comment. You know, it's interesting. My answer to the question, which just because I babbled on so long, I should repeat, is what's kind of one thing that hand therapists should know when working with hand surgeons? It'll be interesting to see what Chris's answer is. I think don't overestimate our knowledge about the hand therapy world. Especially the further we get, I have a super close relationship with different therapists and we work on things and develop protocols together. And then what I like to do for the majority of things is just turn over the patient's care to the therapist. And I'm lucky that that's worked well. I guess I don't always know as much as my therapist thinks I know. And I mean that for real. And that's why I depend so heavily on a really experienced therapist. So don't overestimate my knowledge.
It's funny, for a while there, I thought you were saying that you didn't want the hand therapist to think that you knew too little about hand therapy, but I guess you don't want them to think that you know too much. Is that right? Clarification?
Yes. Sorry, it was confusing. Yes, I know less than you think I know about hand therapy.
You know, I remember starting right after fellowship and being like, wow, I really don't know much about hand therapy. So this actually brings us to a point where I'm toying with a new project idea, and I'm going to say it on the record here so I actually do it, Goldfarb style, hopefully better outcome than the Spanish.
Say it out loud. My wife always says it. Say it out loud in front of friends and family, Chris.
Or, you know, 1,200 downloads a week. So have you ever seen the Netflix series Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee?
I have seen a couple episodes with Jerry Seinfeld, and it is so friggin' funny.
So I'm not Jerry Seinfeld, but I love the conversational format. Just, you know, we're here to talk about one thing. And I really think there is a space for us hand surgeons and orthopedic and plastic surgeons to learn about what the hell goes on at hand therapy. And so we're going to launch a series, a little YouTube video series called Hand Therapy for Hand Surgeons. Maybe we'll come up with a better name. But I already have a list of topics that I came up with and a list of local St. Louis therapists that I want to go to their clinic and I want to be a patient and I want to learn what the hell goes on there.
And that would be with YouTube, because the video component would be important. I mean, no one wants to see your face. Well, maybe they want to see your face and they don't want to see my face. So I think the podcast medium is good for us, but it would not be good for that.
Well, this will just be my hands being on camera. Because I think I've gotten a much better sense as my practice has come along. And we've been fortunate enough to have hand therapy collaborators and colleagues in our clinics in our model. And I've learned so much from just that alone. But I really do want to know more about what happens there. So, you know, coming to a YouTube screen at some point in 2022, watch out for hand therapy for hand surgeons.
Well, and we've been accused of being too agreeable, but I will agree with you that it sounds like a great idea. A little challenging, of course, to find the time, but that's a great idea. And we could all learn something.
You just heard that our executive vice chair just gave me protected time to make a YouTube series.
After you write a few more grants, you got it.
Exactly. So Chuck, well, first off, Megan, thank you for that review. And yes, Chuck and I will have a presence at the ASHT meeting. I know it's a hybrid meeting, so please check us out. I'm doing some pre-course cadaver dissection, which I'm very excited about. And then we're fortunate enough to have one of our sessions selected for the opening portion of the meeting. And it's going to be really cool. It's going to have some patient advocates, some patients, hand therapists, pain management specialists, and I'll provide the surgical perspective.
Yeah. And then the session I had to bow out of, which ultimately will be a good thing for all the ASHT attendees, is on sports and the hand. And Lindley Wall is going to fill in on Saturday morning for that one. So it really looks like a great meeting. So I'm excited it's here in St. Louis and look forward to hearing great things.
You know, I will say that Dr. Wall filling in might be an upgrade. I don't know.
There's no doubt. No doubt. We agree on that too.
So any interesting cases, Chuck?
You know, Chris, I did have an interesting case. It was interesting for a couple of reasons. And, Chris can see my smile. I think this one gave me a little angst, which is why I think it was enjoyable and it was challenging a little bit. So I had an adult patient with macrodactyly, primarily affecting only her thumb. And for that adult patient, she had had a number of previous surgeries, essentially had a large thumb that was insensate and had little motion and caused pain. So you kind of check all the boxes about what good is a thumb and you kind of cross off all the usual stuff. And so even as a post, it wasn't particularly helpful. And so we proceeded with a ray resection of the thumb and an index finger pollicization and did it as an outpatient, sort of in the middle of my normal busy two-room day. But certainly this is one case you can't rush on. And it went really well. And thankfully, viability was not an issue. A little bit of a size mismatch because we used the base of the thumb metacarpal, maintaining that CMC joint. So we had to, think about length and rotation and position. And we used some of the thenar muscles and we saved the adductor. So a lot of the principles that we utilized for what I would call a congenital pollicization, which is the vast majority of what we do, didn't necessarily apply. So it really was a nice mental exercise. And certainly, there's a long way to go for outcome. But I really think this patient's going to be happy.
That's great. I mean, I can only imagine how satisfying it is to do that procedure. And you can obviously really change somebody's life with that procedure. We did the last first hand that we did was with Terry Light. And we talked about, Adrian Flatt and pollicization and Dieter Buck Gramco. And Has your technique varied a lot from what was described by Buck Ramko, or do you still mainly stick with those principles? I know some of the finer details may have changed.
Yeah, you know, first of all, I would say that the politicization procedure is the hallmark procedure for congenital hand surgeons for good reason, and really for two good reasons. One, it's functionally a home run, and two, it's aesthetically a home run. So it's a great procedure, and it's a procedure that I was fortunate to have a mentor that I could work with for years on this procedure, because while there, you know, Paul Mansky wrote a 10-step guide and Scott Cozen actually sort of modified that. But basically there is a stepwise way to approach this. But I think once you do enough of these, and we do about 10 a year, which is a lot. And by we, I say Lindley Wall and I do almost all of them together, which is wonderful. And it's just a procedure that is fun to do because you recognize the impact it can have. And Dieter Buck Ramko, who is considered one of the fathers of congenital hand surgery from Germany, established the basic principles. They've been modified slightly, but I would say in large part, the procedure today looks like it looked, you know, 50 years ago. I think that's about right. When Dr. Bruck or Professor Buck Ramko described it. So really just a cool thing, I think.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, and like everything, people have described subtle differences, a different incision and a different this and a different that. But the fundamental aspects of it are really great. And that's another example of a procedure where therapy collaboration is just incredibly important. How you manage the patient after surgery really determines, you know, how successful your procedure will be.
So, Chuck, I have a burning question for you that brings us to today's topic.
Awesome. I love that you have a topic for today.
it's called myth or fact, radial tunnel syndrome.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think it's a fact. I think it exists. Nerve pain syndrome, which is really what we're talking about, is a little hard to swallow sometimes, but it's real. And I don't think it's common. I'll be interested to know how common you think it is in your busy clinical practice. But if I look at my practice, I would say I do 5 radial tunnel decompressions a year out of 700 or 800 cases. So not many. And I would say a fair number of those are workers' comp. And certainly some of those are tennis elbow associated radial tunnel syndromes. But what do you think? What's your experience?
I think it's real, and I do less than 5 a year. I try to steer these patients away from surgery, mainly because a lot of them, not because the surgery is not effective and I don't think that I can deliver a consistent result, but mainly because a lot of them will get better without surgery, whether that's through observation, waiting for natural regression to the mean, or because they improve with the strategies that our therapy colleagues work with them on. So I don't think it's as common as a lot of people think, but I do think it's real, like you. You know, and I completely agree with you on the frequency, the concomitants with lateral epicondylitis. And, you know, whenever I assess a patient for one, I assess them for both. And it probably is present most of the time in both of them. It's just a matter of them both of those conditions getting better with kind of the same treatment.
All right. So let's talk briefly. I think we want to get a little into the technical, but let's talk briefly. I'll give you one test. What is the one test that you utilize with greatest confidence in making a diagnosis of radial tunnel syndrome?
I'll tell you, it's all relative for greatest confidence with radial tunnel syndrome, but it's point tenderness. So, you know, and it's hard to do that kind of anterior at the most common site where we talk about the fibrous leading edge of the supinator being the most common culprit. It's difficult because, you know, jamming your thumb in that area is kind of painful for a number of reasons. But I do like dorsally kind of walking my way up from the mid portion of the forearm, almost at that, you know, almost like you would be doing a posterior approach, and just walking up from the mid forearm dorsally, trying to get between the EDC and the wrist extensors and feeling in there where you supposedly will be on the distal edge of the supinator and kind of walking in. Because if you start too proximally over the lateral epicondyle, you'll get your tennis elbow pain there. So I always will start with that palpating from distal to proximal, and that will tell me how much of this is radial tunnel versus how much of this is lateral epicondylitis or both. How about you?
Well, first of all, I totally agree. And people talk about, you know, resisted supination and different manipulative tests, but to me, it is all about point tenderness. I think it is really important to test the other side because you're right. You can have native, it is native soreness, but it really it's not soreness. It's just an uncomfortable area to be palpated. And for me, it's like 5 to 7 centimeters distal to lateral epicondyle in that intermuscular, it's really between probably ECRL and EDC. And I think you just get used to where to push, and it can really recreate the pain. I think it's a very effective test.
Now, that being said, I still do the other exam maneuvers, mainly just because it's not hard to do. So, you know, pain with resisted middle finger extension is something I still do and see if it comes up. But I think the diagnostic yield on it is somewhat low. It's just been ingrained in me as to something to do. So I typically just do it quickly.
I do that. And I certainly go through my lateral epicondylitis testing. And I don't inject. I know there are people, listeners, I'm certain, who feel like a lidocaine injection can be helpful. I've just never found it helpful, so I don't inject.
Yeah, there are a lot. The classic teaching is what you got to have a wrist drop in order to know your injection was in the right place. I think that's playing with fire, man. I think that's crazy. But, you know, I've seen that anatomy way too many times to respect the variability of that anatomy. And I think my ability to do that based on, you know, surface anatomy, landmarks, and palpation is not perfect. And I will use an injection as part of my diagnostic and early treatment algorithm in some select cases, and I'll send them for image-guided injection.
So when that is done, are you asking the our physical medicine rehabilitation colleagues, I presume, to inject at the radial tunnel or inject the radial nerve slightly more proximally?
I typically will do it at the radial tunnel, you know, and I'll have them. A lot of times it is just a diagnostic block because I don't love the idea of steroid in that area, but occasionally, depending on the patient, I'll use some steroid. I don't like any more than 2 injections in terms of either diagnostic and or steroid.
And what is the role of nerve studies in the diagnosis of radial tunnel syndrome?
I don't really think they have a role because it oftentimes comes back as negative. Ultrasound has been helpful. I've had some cases where patients have gone for the ultrasound guided injection, and I've asked them to ultrasound the PIN as it enters the supinator. And while, you know, it oftentimes will come back as normal, when it is positive, it is incredibly helpful in terms of counseling and gives you a little more confidence that you're going to help this patient if the nerve is swollen compared to the opposite side.
I love it. So before we jump into the meaty, exciting part, which is the surgical technique, explain to the listeners how you think about therapy. I have to admit, I don't know that I've been as successful as you have with the use of therapy. I certainly believe in therapy for lateral epicondylitis, don't get me wrong, but I don't know if for isolated radial tunnel, I've been very successful. So what are any pearls on how to discuss this with a therapist, or what techniques are most important?
Well, certainly this is an area where we could have one of our hand therapy colleagues join us. But I mean, you know, I think it is mainly about activity modification and adjustments in terms of ergonomics. You know, they end up doing a lot of the stretching and eccentric strengthening as part of, you know, the therapy protocol for lateral epicondylitis. But it's really the activity modifications and getting things to quiet down as much as you can. I do think that oral anti-inflammatories are useful here. I haven't really used topicals here, although it's much more easily available now that diclofenac gel is over the counter. So that's a somewhat easy thing to try. But I don't have any secrets or pearls for therapy. I trust our colleagues enough, as you've mentioned, to let them do their thing. But I do have that listed as a topic for the upcoming video series, Hand Therapy for Hand Surgeons.
My gosh, I love how you work that back in again. I'm always intrigued by the concept of nerve glides for our therapists doing nerve glides and nerve stretching. But again, I'm not sure it's the right technique for this location. I will say that iatrogenically, we can create a radial tunnel. Usually it does get better, but the counterforce brace, which I believe in for lateral epicondylitis, and for lateral epicondylitis, sometimes I use a counterforce brace, sometimes I use a cock-up wrist brace, But the counterforce brace incorrectly applied can really reproduce these symptoms.
I have not encountered that, but I absolutely see how that could happen. So from your perspective, which patients are going to surgery? How long do you try your conservative or non-operative treatments?
Why don't we speak about the isolated radial tunnel rather than the combo? I will try anti-inflammatories, activity modification, and maybe some therapy, which I generally don't laugh, would just suggest it would be an evaluate and treat therapy, modalities, stretching, and I'd probably give it 3 months. Would be my general approach. I wouldn't make it 6 months. I think 3 months is a reasonable time course.
So how are you talking to patients about radial tunnel when they come in? You send them to therapy. Would you not see them back for 3 months? Would you say, you know, when you come back, I think you're going to be better or you're going to be slightly improved. And if you're not better, then we'll talk about other options. And do you yourself incorporate a steroid injection or anything like that in the treatment protocol?
Yeah. So I don't believe in sending patients away for 3 months for anything. Certainly I have my annual follow-ups for some of the congenital stuff, but if a patient has an active problem, sending them away for too long feels like the wrong thing to do. And so, usually for something like this or for tennis elbows, probably 6 weeks, I would see them back, check in, just kind of take the temperature of the room as far as whether they may be a little improved, whether they're more frustrated and go from there. I'm not a steroid injection believer, so I wouldn't do that. So it's really just a matter of anti-inflammatories, therapy, and process whether they are showing any signs of improvement.
So what do you think is the real point of compression here?
Oh, you know, we can name the 5 points of compression, but it's the leading edge of the supinator. I mean, to me, there is no doubt that, and of course, it may not be 100%, but for me, it is darn close to 100%. And so if the patient is frustrated and if their symptoms and signs are reproducible, I think you can with very low risk, very little morbidity, and a relatively rapid recovery, you can decompress the radial nerve. So to me, I think it's a safe, effective surgery.
So when you see these patients and you're doing the surgery and you release the leading edge of the supinator, do you make an effort to see the entirety of the supinator and release the nerve throughout the entirety of the supinator and see it exit or emerge? Or do you not just, but do you only release the leading edge?
Yeah, I have done these both with an anterior approach, and we should talk about this, and a dorsal approach. And I don't want to release the entire supinator because I think that does add some morbidity. But I don't want to release the whole thing. And so for me, it's about the leading edge. And you can get a sense of what's going on in the supinator, but not, I don't want to release the whole thing.
See, this is where my bias comes in as the person who sees the recurrent, you know, referral cases or questionable recurrence of radial tunnel. I know that you can't get the entirety of the supinator in all patients from an anterior approach. And that was demonstrated nicely in a cadaver study from the HSS group. So I just worry about, you know, releasing the leading edge alone, knowing that that's going to be the case 95% of the time as the compressive point, but not seeing the distal edge and then having to come back on my own case. And that's a pride thing, I guess. But I agree with you entirely that this, you know, releasing the entirety of the supinator does add morbidity. You know, I think that, you know, I'm young in my career, but I've noted that, you know, the things that really hurt patients in terms of postoperative pain, it's whenever you do work on bone in terms of drilling, but then also a large amount of intramuscular dissection hurts.
Both fair points. I would say, and you may disagree, which I kind of hope you do just for a little spice. I would say that I believe I can differentiate proximal nerve compression where the nerve enters the supinator and distal nerve irritability where the nerve exits the supinator based on my physical exam. Now, whether I have great confidence in that, I don't know. But I think if it's a classic examination, then I am very comfortable releasing the leading edge and, you know, gently palpating and visualizing a little more distally and understanding that I'm not going to completely release the exit point. But if it's a distal point of discomfort, I think it's very different. So that's how I think about it.
Wait, so time out. Hold on. You said earlier that on your physical exam, the most important thing is, you know, starting distally and walking your way in from 7 centimeters distal to lateral epicondyle and seeing where there's pain. And is that the area where you think there's compression, or do you think that's just an irritable nerve?
No, you're conflating what you said and what I said. You're putting your words in my mouth. No, I said 7 centimeters distal, 5 to 7 centimeters distal to lateral epicondyle is that point, which is the classic leading edge. And if it's more distal in the forearm, and I'm pointing to kind of halfway down the forearm, then I think, and I don't know that even in me, not very muscular, but somewhat thin, I don't think I can feel that exit point, but it's just a very different location. I absolutely believe that I've had patients that have pain at the exit point, not the entrance point.
So you think that at 5 to 7 centimeters distal to lateral epicondyle, that's the entrance point of the PIN deep to the supinator.
Correct.
And is that when you're, are you palpating that dorsally or volarly / radially?
No, dorsally.
Dorsally.
Okay. Yep. That dorsal soft spot. Yep.
Okay. I can't say I agree with that.
I love it. I would have been disappointed if you did. So what is your favorite approach? Do you always go dorsal, always go volar? Do you modify?
You know, I think that, you know, there are a lot of ways to get there, right? So, you know, just in terms of clarifying for those that are listening who may not be familiar with the surgical approaches, the ones that are classically described, you know, for an anterior approach to the radial tunnel, that would be between the brachioradialis and the brachialis. An anterolateral approach would be between the ECRL and the brachioradialis. And then a posterior approach would be between the ECRB and the EDC. I think they're the first two are a lot easier to accomplish from a surgical perspective. I think you can accomplish the first two for sure through the same skin incision. You know, so one skin incision, different surgical windows. I typically will start by, you know, kind of more anterior than anything else, working underneath the brachioradialis because you have your SRN as a guide to help you walk into the radial tunnel. So you start a little bit distal to the radial tunnel, you find your SRN, you dissect proximally, and you find where the PIN is coming off. And that, I think, is the most reliable and easiest. Perhaps you don't need that extensive of a dissection, but I think that, especially working with trainees, that's a very reliable approach. So I typically will start with an anterior and then see how distal I could get. Because in, you know, when you go with a straight anterior approach, you probably will leave some of that supinator behind. And if your goal is to decompress the entirety of the supinator muscle, you may need that anterolateral, even a posterior surgical approach. How do you think about this?
Marty Boyer, one of our partners, always goes anteriorly. And I have to say, I started my career by always going anteriorly. And the pearls I have are, you know, your dissection, your incision point is just on the ulnar side of the BR, the brachioradialis. You protect the LABC and you work in that interval as Chris described. And then you will always encounter the arcade of Froche. And I typically would either use the clip applier or I would tie those with 2-0 silk ties and then expose the nerve. As you said, the best way to find the nerve is to find the superficial branch of the radial nerve, trace it proximally, and then trace the motor nerve more distally. It's a very elegant approach. I think it heals beautifully. And I think patients do well. For me, it's a soft dressing and a rapid recovery. I'm trying to think of what other pearls I have. I think that as long as you handle those vessels appropriately, as long as you protect the lateral and brachial cutaneous nerve, I think you have a beautiful exposure of the majority of the nerve as it enters the muscle. As you eloquently stated, you don't see the nerve distally. And therefore, if you're worried about the nerve distally, you have to consider other options.
And you being the astute clinician you are, essentially, you know, Sir Osler yourself can tell that it's a distally compressed nerve. I will say I tease, but I can actually, I think in a recurrent case, that is spot on. But I think you're right because you're playing the odds because most of the times it is the fibrous leading edge of the supinator. And that can be a really tight band. And I think that just in terms of, you know, for the anatomy, you know, nerds out there, it's really cool anatomy in that area. There's all sorts of variability. So you just need to be aware of the variability because oftentimes you can have branches innervating the ECRB coming off of the SRN, coming off of the radial nerve, you know, that bifurcation of the SRN and the PIN, or even coming off more proximally. So just things you need to be aware of. And there are these little wispy nerves that power the supinator, which are super important to us nerve nerds, because you can use that as a nerve transfer in some cases, that you just need to be aware of. And I think the biggest variation that that surgeons need to be aware of is that the textbooks say that the PIN is going to stay deep to the superficial head of the supinator muscle, and then it'll exit, you know, kind of staying between the deep and superficial heads. But there are some variations in which it will poke through the superficial head. And if you are hell-bent on decompressing the entire thing, or even getting to that distal quarter of it, you can see that nerve come through superficially. You just need to be aware that you need to see the nerve at all times, keep it down, keep the superficial portion of the supinator up during the decompression.
Yeah, well said. I mean, we could do a whole episode about my really refined physical exam techniques, such as checking your hemoglobin by the beefy red color of your inner gums, which of course I check for every patient. And what is this about supinator motor branches? Are those the ones I cut right through?
Those are the ones where you can actually hear the supinator gasping as you cut it. I guess you're cutting the muscle anyway, so why does it matter, right?
Absolutely. So I will say, in all seriousness, as we wind down, the when I go dorsally, often it is in combination with a lateral epicondylitis procedure, and you can make a slightly larger incision, have good exposure. What is really interesting about that approach is that when it goes well, meaning when you find that nice interval, as you said, between ECRB and EDC, it's a beautiful exposure of the nerve. Now, you can't get super far proximally with that approach, but it's a beautiful exposure. But there is a risk. There is a risk that developing that interval can be tricky for some patients. And if it's tricky, you just have to make a bigger incision and you find the appropriate interval. But that's the hesitation. That's why for a younger surgeon just starting out, you might choose to go volarly, because it's just more reliable anatomy.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, so I actually did a variation of this case. You know, so I do a fair bit of radial tunnel decompression when I'm doing nerve transfers anyway. I guess I didn't count that in my my tally earlier, but I did a case like this recently where I was trying to find the deep branch of the PIN as part of a nerve transfer strategy. So I used it. I started with an anterior approach, but you know, as part of this newer nerve transfer, you go dorsally as well, because you're going to flip the AIN back to transfer to the deep branch of the PIN. And we can talk about that in a separate episode, because it's a really cool concept. But essentially, you have to do a dorsal approach too. And nothing brings me more joy in doing some of these cases than perfectly nailing that interval and doing it largely with, honestly, a knife and a freer. And it is beautiful anatomy. And you know, I guess you're using the Goldfarb dissector there too.
Oh yeah, the finger dissector. I mean, what's this without a freer elevator? Just use the finger.
You know, I think that it's just much more elegant. And you got a freer. I use my finger a fair bit. It's, you know, nothing's going to give you better tactile feedback. We had an attending in my residency who would call it the Leiden blade, because his last name was Leiden. He's like, get the Leiden blade in there, shine the anatomy.
We all have our favorite dissectors, whether it be finger or Raspley elevator for me or whatever. I will ask one additional question, maybe a final question. I have attempted the brachioradialis splitting approach for this technique and found it to be extraordinarily frustrating. And maybe I just chose the wrong patient with the beefy brachioradialis, but I would not do that again. Have you done that approach?
No, I don't like the BR approach, splitting BR. If you're there, you might as well go between ECRL and brachioradialis. You know, there's a really nice interval there. And Dr. McKinnon has a really nice video on this, in which you can see a cutaneous nerve running in that plane. And even the muscles themselves, you can see the difference in the color of the muscle because the fascia is thicker on one of them. So it's a beautiful plane to expose. So if you're thinking BR splitting, you might as well just go between BR and ECRL for your true anterolateral approach. I do have a couple of technical questions I wanted to ask you to bring it to a close.
Let's do it.
So two things. When you are dividing the superficial head of the supinator muscle, do you do that with tenotomies, with the knife, with a bipolar, with something crazy like a Bovie? And then do you let your tourniquet down before you close the wound?
I think that for me, the second question is easier. This is one of the cases, and I'll be interested. I think there's two cases that immediately come to mind where I always let the tourniquet down. This is one of them. And the other is this CMC arthroplasty, especially if we are in close proximity to the radial artery, which you pretty much always are. Those are the two cases that I routinely let the tourniquet down. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah. And there are cases, you know, sometimes where I'll let the tourniquet down and I'll do what I call flash the tourniquet. You let it down for a good 15, 20 seconds, see if there's anything arterial. And if not, reinflate the tourniquet to allow for closure. Some would argue that you've already lost kind of your seal and it doesn't do you much good. But I do find that to be helpful. And then I'll answer my question first and then you can give your input. I tend to take the supinator down with the bipolar. I do like the hemostasis that provides, but I'd use a bipolar on kind of a lower setting. And obviously the bipolar doesn't have as much scatter as a Bovie.
So let's be clear for our audience. When you talk about the superficial and deep heads of the supinator, you're talking about muscle origin from the either distal humerus or proximal ulna. Is that correct?
Well, not so much origin. I'm going right over the nerve. I want to create a path for that nerve. So I'm not taking it off of the bone. I'm actually taking it in the middle of the muscle belly, which is why I asked the question of, I guess maybe if you do it differently, but hemostasis does matter at that point because you don't want to create a large hematoma because obviously that muscle is going to ooze.
I guess I think about it differently. I really don't think about the muscular heads, superficial, deep, whatever. I simply think about the leading edge, that fibrous leading edge of the supinator. I release that as distally as I believe it needs to be released such that you're not fighting that fibrous edge. And typically, therefore, I use scissors because you're cutting tendon, really, and then bluntly spreading thereafter, trying to palpate. Now, I don't really believe I can palpate compression distally, but trying to palpate a smooth, sufficient space for the nerve.
Got it. Yeah, I think I'd take it a little bit further and probably maybe I'm doing too much, but, I will release the fibrous edge with the tenotomy scissors, and I'll go after the muscle with a bipolar.
Perfect. All right. This has been fun.
I think it's been fun. And, thank you for making me commit. I committed myself to doing something new. So we'll see how this YouTube series goes.
I love it. All right. Have a good evening.
Take care. Bye.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at Chris DMD, spelled DY. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.